The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Hello, you are tuned to Music Weekly. I'm Alexis Petrides. This week, we'll be hearing from writer Pat Long about the glory days of the NME, when staff generally stayed up all night and liked to kick the working day off with a giant spliff. Similar to The Guardian. We'll be talking to the Silver Seas, a band currently enjoying a UK love-in. And somewhere in the middle of all that, we'll be auditioning some new releases and singles club. That's all here on Music Weekly from The Guardian. On board with me this week are Guardian culture editor Alex Needham. Hello.
Hello.
And Kieran Yates.
Hello.
Fresh back from the Philippines.
Yep.
You've brought a musical instrument.
Oh, yeah.
Back from the Philippines. This is amazing. They say the age of live music is dead. Well, it's happening. It's happening right here and now at Music Weekly. What is it?
Exactly. It's called a kumbing, and it's a jaw harp made of bamboo.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw it, and it's traditionally used for courting. So I thought,
wow.
I'm going to take this back and use it on Alexis.
Okay, well let's see
happily
if I can...
married, though.
Yeah. Well, you know...
Just for practice, just to see if
sure,
it works.
Sure, go on then.
Okay, are you ready?
Yeah.
Okay.
I have to say, it's not a sound that speaks of, you know, untrammeled eroticism.
Maybe so that dodgy springs.
It would be brilliant if, so like the Filipino equivalent of Barry White.
Exactly.
There'd be this big kind of, hey baby, I'm going to love you a little bit more. And then he'd go, wang, 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 wang.
It's more for messages, like a sexy Morse code.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Wow.
That's right.
That's amazing. Well, that's totally fantastic. Let's talk a little bit about news this week. What's been happening? My favourite news story of the week. Atlas Sound. Have you heard about this? It's amazing. Atlas Sound played a gig in Minneapolis last Friday. You know, Atlas Sound, I'm sure you know,
yeah.
Listeners know, sort of well-regarded American indie rock band, like shoegazy, offshoot of Deerhoof. And their frontman of Atlas Sound, Bradford Cox, came on stage looking a bit the worse for wear, apparently. Played a couple of songs. Then somebody in the audience did a comedy heckle and went, "Play My Sharona." So he proceeded to play My Sharona for an hour. And the description of the gig is amazing. It says, Cox asked people to take their clothes off. He shouted seemingly intoxicated defences about his art. He simulated fellatio. All the while repeatedly warning the crowd, this is what happens when you make requests. I just thought that was totally amazing.
It sounds like quite a show.
Brilliant.
I've been to shows where nothing like that happened.
The only thing I thought about this, I mentioned this on Twitter the other day, and somebody said, of course, he thinks he's short-circuited this. Obviously, every gig the guy plays at from now on, someone in the audience is going to go, play My Sharona. And I love a good audience heckle. Have you heard any good ones, Kieran?
Well, I saw Jay-Z perform at Jules Holland a few years ago, and one of the best heckles from the crowd were just people shouting, "What's your pin?" to Jay, which I thought was really funny. I'm one of them, obviously.
I'm an unending fan of the Freebird heckle.
Yes.
I'd love to know where that comes from. I've no idea. The best time I ever heard it deployed was a gig by the Free Jazz Guitar Improv guy Derek Bailey. After about an hour, during which he played not a recognisable note, it was wah, 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 somebody went Freebird. And loads of people didn't think it was funny. After I would love to know where the Freebird heckle comes from. Who first did it? What it's, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Would it be a punk thing?
Is it a punk thing? Play Freebird. Yeah, play something good. I don't know if you know, if any of the readers know from whence the Freebird heckle came. More prominent, I think, in the States.
I like the audience participation, though.
You think you should more of that?
There's those stories from old school forward nights where people, you know, would kind of run from the back when they heard a tune that was playing.
Mm.
And they would, like, run and kind of wheel up the tune themselves. So they'd reach
really?
Over the decks, yeah, and wheel
wow.
it up.
Only really?
Only, like, the regulars.
Enough about what's happening at the moment. Let us return to a time when Top of the Pops still existed, and Nick Kent could show up to work at the NME with his testicles clearly visible. Again, very similar to The Guardian. We're a very free and easy company. You want to come here with your testicles visible, I'm sure you'd be welcomed with open arms. That's mutualisation. I wasn't there myself, obviously. I was busy being born. But you can read all about such things in a new book called The History of the Enemy, High Times and Low Lives at the World's Most Famous Music Magazine. Its author, Pat Long, spoke to our very own Tim Jones, both NME veterans, and began by recalling his own time at the paper.
The two things I used to do in kind of the latter years when I worked at NME, with you in fact, which was kind of at the end of the noughties, one of them was get a taxi into town on expenses at lunchtime and buy records. And the other one on a Friday afternoon was go down at about 2 o'clock after we'd finished putting the issue to bed and sit in this kind of airless bunker, windowless bunker in NME's publisher, IPC's basement, and go through all these kind of mouldering old copies of the paper. And that was kind of my afternoon for a year, probably. I kind of ended up feeling a bit jealous that if you were an NME journalist in the 1970s, you could just phone up Bob Dylan or John Lennon or David Bowie or whoever and go around their house and spend a whole day with them. Whereas nowadays, even if you're interviewing a new band, you get kind of 25 minutes with a press officer sitting in the corner making sure they don't say anything out of line. So one of the things that appealed to me about the NME in the 1970s was just the access that you got to the stars, I guess. And also the fact that there were these really fascinating, huge-selling characters to write about, which I'm not sure is the case for the current generation of NME journalists. You know, you haven't got these people who were... Well, Top of the Pops doesn't exist anymore, but these people who were on Top of the Pops who were also total lunatics, like David Bowie or Ian Dury or Jarvis Cocker even. And the other thing was that in the 1970s and 1980s, the only way you could find out about what your favourite band were doing or where they were playing next or what their latest haircut was or whatever it was by reading the NME. And, you know, in the 70s, I think about 1 million people a week read this paper because it was the sole source of information for the underground, you know. The mainstream media didn't touch pop music at all, apart from to talk about it in this weird, desiccated academic way, you know.
There's a brilliant bit in the book where someone from kind of the old school has a go at reviewing the Beatles, isn't there?
Yeah.
And I can't remember the exact phrase, but it's so funny the way they're trying to make a case basically for it being like Beethoven or something.
That's right, yeah. And, you know, it famously Melody Maker, which was obviously NME's big rival, even though it was owned by the same company, one of their prerequisites for working there until about 1975 was you had to be able to read music,
yeah,
which just seems kind of totally alien, really, you know.
You talk about the 70s. I mean, that's obviously seen as the golden age of NME. Is that what struck you after doing all the research for the book, that was the golden age? Because in a way, it was quite a horrible time to work there. I mean, there was a lot of tension, there's drugs, but not good drugs.
Sure.
Very bad drugs.
Yeah.
And
going back and reading some of the writing in those papers, it's really bad. You know, probably for the reasons that you've described. You know, they were all, you know, staying up all night, smoking weed or stronger with Keith Richards and Bob Marley. They all hated each other's guts. They were all at each other's throats. They worked in this horrible office called Kingsreach Tower, which is this really ugly tower block on the South Bank by Blackfriars. And up until that point, they'd had an office in the centre of town in Covent Garden where they could just behave the way they wanted to. And suddenly, any illusion they had that they were working for a kind of underground newspaper was shattered by the fact that suddenly they've got an office next door to Shoot or Yachting World or whatever. And famously, the staff of the other magazines that had to share office space with the NME complained because Nick Kent used to wander around in a pair of leather trousers with a rip on the crotch so that his testicles would be dangling out when he was in the lift. And also people complained about the fact that the staff of the NME used to start the day with passing around a huge communal joint. You know, that was their way of getting into the working spirit. So, I'm not sure I would have wanted to write for the paper in the 1970s, apart from the fact that you, as I say, you would have got this incredible access to these amazing pop stars.
I mean, one thing that struck me reading the book was how much the criticisms that you read about NME today have been there pretty much from the minute it started.
Right.
People, you know, it's constantly falling out of touch with what was cool. The staff were getting too old and it had to reinvent itself over and over again.
Sure,
there's a brilliant editorial from, I think, the mid-60s where they're basically... Might be the editor or one of the features editor basically has a rant about how long hair is not hygienic.
Right, yeah.
Which, you know, you can't imagine what the readers thought of this.
Yeah, it? Yeah,
so,
of course. People love to moan about how the NME isn't as good as it used to be, right? And that normally means it isn't as good as it was when you were 16 and you just started reading it. I found this fantastic letter from a reader from 1953, and this is a year after the magazine was started, and it was a letter from someone complaining that it wasn't as good as it used to be. So yeah, I mean, this has always gone on, and you know, let's face it, the magazine is aimed at teenagers, you know, so that gives its readership a kind of a lifespan, really, that by the time you get to university or whatever, you stop reading the paper. Mm-hmm. The other interesting thing about The Enemy is it's given a whole generation of, you know, mostly working class misfits an opportunity to create a career. I'm not talking about you, by the way. To create a career for themselves in the media that's still largely, perhaps not so much anymore, dominated by Oxbridge people. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the roll call of people that have worked for the paper over the last 60 years, it's really remarkable, you know, as well as people like, obviously, Anton Corbijn and the famous writers like Judy Birchall and Tony Parsons, you know. Bob Geldof wrote for the paper, Chrissy Hynde wrote for the paper, Clive James did live reviews for the paper, Michael Winner was the film critic in the 1950s. Yeah, it's a real thrill to be able to say that you worked there, I think.
Who is it who says Enemy was like Cambridge for losers?
That's right, yeah.
Is that David Quantick?
Yeah, David Quantick said that, yeah, and it's totally true, you know.
After all the research you've done, what would you say the favourite kind of fact that you found out was, or the funniest story?
Well, there's so much, really. One of the things I wanted to write about in the book was kind of what it was like to be a musician on the other side of the tape recorder, as it were. So there's loads of great stories about, like, Don Arden, who was famously fearsome rock manager who managed the Small Faces, turning up at the office one day with two heavies and threatening to break someone's legs because they'd written a bad review. Or Andrew Collins, who wrote for the paper in the 80s and 80s and 90s, got sent a box of human excrement by a band that he'd written a dismissive thing about. And I write in the introduction of the book as well about how I wrote a really tiny but dismissive single review of the Stereophonics, and every day for about a month I came into work to find a voicemail message left by a man just screaming abuse at me into my answer phone, you know. But I didn't really mind, really. It kind of felt like, I'm glad that there was that reaction. I'm glad that someone felt that aggrieved about a 60-word single review.
Well, I think that's the secret for The Enemy's success and why it's kept going for 60 years, is it has that relationship with its readers and it manages to enrage them so much.
That's
and if
right.
that ever stops, I think that's when the magazine will actually be in real trouble.
I mean, I think The Enemy's always given a voice to a kind of a sensibility that didn't really or doesn't really exist anywhere else in the media. Perhaps that's less true now, but like, around the 1987 election, they famously put Neil Kinnock on the front cover of the paper the week before the election, at a point where Kinnock couldn't get press anywhere else. You know, certainly the Fleet Street wouldn't interview him, wouldn't touch him. And Peter York wrote this fantastic thing about how in the late 70s and early 80s, you get this magazine that was on sale in John Menzies or W.H. Smith next to Home and Garden and next to Women's Own or whatever, that was writing about drugs and radical politics and gay rights, and it was pro-green and pro-nuclear disarmament, all this fantastic stuff that you wouldn't be able to read about in any other mainstream publication. And I think that it's fair to say that a lot of the stuff that Enemy wrote about during that time, the kind of the liberal sensibilities that it espoused, have really filtered down into the wider culture.
Mm-hmm. What was it like meeting all these kind of old writers? A warning sign. Well, I mean, it must have been fun, kind of.
Oh, of course it was.
Who struck you as the kind of most dynamic personality?
You know, in my head, they were kind of as big as stars as the people they were writing about. You know, so a lot of them I was quite nervous to meet, as if I'd be going to meet, you know, David Bowie or someone. And I was struck by how kind of open they were about their experiences. You know, because as you say, a lot of the time the office wasn't a particularly pleasant place to be. And certainly when I was talking to them, there was a sense that a lot of them were still perhaps a little bit damaged by their experience of working for The Enemy. And also that there was a lot of, you know, a lot of them still had an axe to grind, and there was a sense of them, their kind of personal rivalries that have been in place for the last 25, 35, 45 years were still being played out now, you know.
I suppose last question, just any thoughts on kind of where Enemy's going to go, or if you think it's still going to be around in... You know, 20, 30 years' time.
I mean, it's impossible to say. It's the 60th anniversary. I think it's a really good magazine at the moment, and I really still enjoy it. I mean, obviously, it's not. I'm 35. It's not aimed at me. But, I don't want to make predictions about what the future of the paper is because obviously it's still read really widely, perhaps not in print, but its online incarnation does really well. I don't know if people have the same relationship with enemy.com as they would have had rushing to buy their newspaper every Wednesday morning. One of the recurring stories, actually, from talking to people was so many people used to go to Tottenham Court Road tube station on a Tuesday lunchtime because you could buy The Enemy a day ahead of everybody else. It was normally published on a Wednesday, and for some reason there was one newsstand in Tottenham Court Road that used to have these early copies of the paper, and so many people that I spoke to said they used to go and do that. I mean, Tony Parsons used to do that, Neil Tennant used to do that, Jonathan Ross used to do that. And I can't imagine anyone feeling the same way and feeling that kind of level of dedication to any publication really anymore.
That was Pat Long talking to Tim Jones. The history of the Enemy, High Times and Low Lives at the World's Most Famous Music Magazine, is available from all the usual book outlets. It's the 60th anniversary, isn't it?
It is.
Let's declare an interest here. Alex, you used to work at the NME.
I was deputy editor of the NME, yes. I started there in 2001, so just after the Strokes. Right. Well, actually pretty much simultaneously to their first EP coming out, which was very fortuitous. And then I left at the end of 2006. The last cover was My Chemical Romance, I think.
Right. Was the magazine starting to flounder by then, did you feel?
Well, we had a really good first half of the decade, actually. It was difficult at first because there was the Strokes, basically, that was it for guitar bands, although they were an extremely good one. Mm. Then the White Stripes appeared, and then after that, Black Rebel Motorcycle Club appeared, who everyone's forgotten about now. But were kind of quite... we were very grateful for them at the time. Then the Hives. And then kind of once the Libertines came, suddenly it all got momentum, and then suddenly there were tons of guitar bands. And I think that is just the thing that NME is best at.
Yeah.
And I remember it got to 2004 and we were at Glastonbury. Loads of them were on the bill, you know, round about tea time as well. So they weren't so big that they weren't in your world anymore. And we had a lot of fun and got a lot of good value out of them. It did become hard round about the, you know, a couple of years later, but you just realise the massive change there has been. And ultimately it's to do with the internet, social networking, YouTube started when I was there, you know, and a lot of the things that the NME used to do, which was bring you new bands and tell you about new bands, are suddenly done so much more efficiently by so many other media. It makes it very difficult for...
Do you think, Kieran, do you think there's still a market for music magazines, or is it a completely archaic thing? I mean, on the scene from, you know, that is your home, the urban scene, is there a necessity for magazines like Rewind and stuff like that, or would the scene just develop without them?
Well, for me personally, I think not only being a journalist, but I always remember kind of reading Rewind and buying music magazines, and I think now the first place that I go to, and I think a lot of people go to, is blogs. Mm. And I think, you know, it's all about kind of blog rolling and blog searching and kind of downloading mixtapes for free and all that. But actually things like, publications like Rewind and lots of underground publications like that are actually really important, I think, in terms of just really being one place where you know that, you know the remit, you know what you're going to get, you know if it's underground or, you know, it's... kind of indie bands or whatever, because they still exist, or, you know, like grime MCs, you know, then you're going to find them in one place and they're going to look, you know, amazing, and you can put a face to, you know, the names that you've heard. And I think that they serve a really important purpose in that kind of way, because you kind of might hear a name like Lady Leisha, and you might hear the song and you might hear it on SoundCloud, but, you know, when you see this kind of double page spread of her, you're like, oh, right, okay. And I think that's an image that still sticks.
It is weird to just deal with an entire tidal wave of music when you've got no context to it, and I think that's something that music journalism will provide and that will always be needed. I mean, whether it's supplied by monthly or weekly magazines, you know, I get the impression that people in their teens probably get that information from somewhere else, but you do need it. And I think it's natural to be interested in people who are making records that move you Unoffendly, they tend to be very interesting.
Well, you do need a filter.
Yeah.
It's funny, I was talking to somebody about Six Music, which is also celebrating its birthday next week. I think it's 10 years since Six Music started. And this person was a Six Music naysayer, and they were going, there's no point in it. It's just spoon-feeding people culture they could find on the internet. They should close it down and use the money on the World Service. And I thought, well, you could say that about, A, you could say that about any radio station, and B, you need, as you say, you need some sort of filter. Yes, there is all this infinite amount of music out there, but how do you decide what's good, what's not? You know, these things still, radio stations, magazines, blog, they still have a role to play, you know? I think that's a really intriguing idea, that you don't need this stuff anymore.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the idea of just absorbing music as music, you know, it's a very nice one, and it's what pop stars always say they would like to happen.
Yeah.
But if it did happen, it would be confusing, boring. You know, stuff has to mean something, and that context just doesn't come from pure sound. It comes from the culture that surrounds it, the people who are into it, and the people who are making it.
Also, on a more kind of just a grassroots level, it's about ownership. It's about having that commodity of a magazine that's yours, and that's, you know, you can look through it, you can keep referring back to it, and it, you know, it adds as part of a collection, and it's this kind of tangible thing that you can engage with. And I think there's always going to be a need for that, and I think that people are always going to want to see that.
That's interesting.
I mean, that's very, very, very true in Britain particularly. You know, magazines have always been a bit of a rallying point for people who are into the same thing. You know, you can see that whether it was The Face in the 80s, you know, NME for indie kids, Kerrang for people who are into heavy metal. I think they're just sort of tangible manifestations of the kind of passion that British young people have for music, and I think there's something that's totally to be celebrated and cherished about that.
I always feel a bit sorry for the NME, because people always go, it's not as good as it was, you know, da-da-da-da. I remember once talking to Nick Kent about this, and he said, everyone goes on about the golden age of the NME in the 70s, and he goes, you know, obviously not a man who's backward and coming forward about his own fabulousness, but said, you know, there's my stuff and Lester Bangs' stuff and, you know, Charlie Murray's, and that was great. And he goes, but the rest of it, it was all shit.
Yeah.
He goes, these hagiographic articles about, you know, Emerson, Lake and Palmer. And he said, it was absolutely terrible. And the era that I sort of was really into the NME, which I suspect is the era that everybody is really into the NME when they're sort of 17, 18, I found a big stack of them. When I moved house recently, and I looked through them, and I remember it being just amazing. And it was basically, it wasn't very good. You know, it wasn't like an amazing publication. It's more just getting this stuff out there. You know what I mean?
Well, I think ultimately, great magazines are of their time, and the idea is that it's not built to last. Really, you know, you're not laying down a historical document to be kind of, you know, studied in generations' time. You're talking about what's happening and what's exciting that week.
Absolutely.
Often you're doing it quite fast and on the fly.
Yeah.
And, you know, and if you're lucky, you manage to capture some of that excitement that's happening at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I mean, you know, you look at the charts and music in general, there's, you know, often things stand the test of time, often they don't, but it's all part of what's exciting and just what's happening.
Do you think the NME is going to survive? Because a lot of people are saying it's not going to see a 61st birthday.
Well, I was there for the 50th anniversary, and people were mithering that it wasn't going to survive then. So it's not really changed. I mean, you know, which is what the publishers say, that the platform has changed, you know, and people have migrated onto the internet. But I do think that, you know, the NME is an absolute kind of totemic music magazine and a kind of totemic brand. I find it difficult to believe that it would just be allowed to disappear into the ether. But, you know, the means of delivering it might change.
Yeah,
do you guys buy it? Do you both buy it, or do you still buy it?
I get it sent free, I'm afraid.
I buy it on occasion.
I mean, in a lot of ways, I always say blame the band. I think it's the band's fault that if NME's having a weak time, you know, there should be more interesting bands to write about. Often, you know, it's fortunes rise and decline with what's happening in guitar music at the time. You know, that's just the way it is.
Mm. The NME, High Times and Low Lives at the World's Most Famous Music Magazine, is available from all the usual book outlets. Highly recommended. I really enjoyed it. Now, time for Singles Club. Kieran, let's start with your choice.
Thank you.
That's Rusty, Surf, featuring Nightwave. That's your choice, Kieran. Yeah, tell us about it.
It's just so good. I just love it. Oh, I love it.
It's a bit brilliant. More analytical than that.
It's brilliant. It is a rework of one of the tracks that was called Surf, that was on Glass Swords, Rusty's album that was out last year.
The Guardian debut album of the year.
Yeah, but I don't want to talk too much about Rusty because I think The Guardian has said everything that needs to be said about how how great he is.
Okay.
But yeah, Nightwave, formerly known as 8-Bitch.
Right.
She changed her name, the number 8-Bitch.
Yeah.
And then she changed her name. Her real name is Maja Medvesek. She's from Slovenia. And she's like a DJ, producer, vocalist, and so she's done the vocals on this, which has been like a vocal rework, and I think they've also kind of added a bit of synth and a bit of bass and just chucked it all together and made it sound amazing and better than the original, because actually I thought that the single was one of the weaker, well, the track was one of the weaker on the Glass Swords album, but this has really kind of reinvigorated it, and it sounds quite good. And I was reading the press release this morning, and apparently she's also a judo champion.
Wow.
Yeah.
I love her work. It's certainly not stinting on the kind of maximalist style of production for which Rusty has been famed.
Yeah.
Not sort of paring it back any. Alex, did you like it?
I did like it. I mean, it's like, as people have said, it's almost like the last two decades of music sort of put in
at
a
once.
Blender. Yeah, all played at once. So you've got your kind of mid-90s West Coast hip-hop and the sort of R&B that was massive at the turn of the century and more modern stuff as well. And then the kind of ravey euphoria. I think it works. It's strange in that it is, you know, it does sound like pop completely eating itself.
Mm.
But I think it would be interesting if it's a hit and it does go into the mainstream, because then it's almost competing with its sort of inspirations. It'd be interesting if
it's a fascinating idea.
Yeah.
You know, it's always a fascinating idea when warped pop music of one kind or another actually ends up, you know what I mean, being taken as pop music, whether that's, you know, new pop in the early 80s or this, or, you know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely. Well, I think it's a record that's been intended as quite avant-garde, I think, and it's come from an avant-garde place, but has got a lot of pop appeal. And I think it'll be a bit of a through the looking glass moment if he does actually manage suddenly to be in the charts at the same time as David Guetta and
absolutely.
Kind of
it's
weird
rave
meets hip-hop stuff that's huge at the moment.
Absolutely.
It's interesting that you talk about those kind of trends of sounds, because I think that actually female vocals on electronica has become a really staple sound over the last 5 years, seven years, and has kind of, through the medium of dubstep, made it through into mainstream charts. So, yeah, like you say, it'll be interesting to see with something a little bit more left field.
He hadn't sold a lot of copies of the album. I mean, there was that thing where somebody listed how much, you know, things that were in the end of year, I think it was the Guardian's end of year list, had sold. And he hadn't sold a lot, which is odd in a way, I think, because, I mean, on one level it's not odd, because it's, as you say, it does sound like loads of music playing at the same time. In another way, there is something sort of weirdly commercial about it. I can't put my finger on what it is.
Yeah, like this, like you would totally dance to this. Because I remember you saying, oh, you know, do people in raves dance to Rusty?
Mm-hmm.
And I just think like this, like you definitely would. I think this has got massive appeal. You know, you could like listen to it anywhere and you definitely want to dance to it.
It's maybe just a little bit too kind of dense and confusing to get on the radio, you know, dense as in the soap. There's just so much going on. I mean, in one way, he's sort of been aimed at your more chin-strokey
end of
the market, hasn't he?
Mm.
But at the same time, there's definitely a very strong pop element there as well.
Interesting, all those adjectives you used. Let's move on to Alex's choice. Rufus Wainwright, Out of the Game. That's Alex's choice. I was saying that all those adjectives that you used to describe Rusty could probably be used to describe a large proportion of Rufus Wainwright's oeuvre.
Yes.
He always says, I've noticed the thing with Rufus Wainwright, he goes, this album, you know, I've pared it down a bit. This is my sort of bid for commercial success. And it's this ridiculous kind of, wherever he does this immense camp opus that sort of velvet drapes and, you know, it's all too utterly utter. Is this the one where he's done that? Is this the one where he's pared it down?
It is quite a big sound. I mean, his last one was just him and a piano. but that was his post-opera mother died thing. So this is him returning to pop music. Mark Ronson produced it. Not that you can particularly tell.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
I think it's been pared down in as much as his previous albums, particularly 1 and 2, they tended to have big orchestras on. There's no orchestra on this. However, there is gospel choir, brass section, and loads of other instruments as well. It's got a very... I didn't think I liked it when I first heard it last week, but it has... I have grown to love it. It's very clever. You know, the tune doesn't do what you expect it to do. It's very songwriterly. But, you know, I think it's appealing. You know, it won't win him any new fans. In a way, this is him trying to engage with the kids. Apparently, it's about...
Really?
Apparently, it's about young people who watch YouTube all the time and sort of thinking that they're suckers, and then later on thinking, oh, actually, I'd quite like to be like them. So this is his midlife crisis record, which obviously appeals to me for obvious reasons.
Kieran, what did you make of it?
I also read the same thing about it, about kind of being aimed at this YouTube-obsessed generation. And, like you say, there's this kind of choir that comes in a little bit later, and it's got that, you know, twangy, and you think that, oh, you know, yeah, I could down with this. Is quite, you know, upbeat, maybe, but actually it's desperately sad, and he's just like, oh, he's kind of poor, pathetic old man trying to...
pathetic old man? He's like 10 years older than I am.
It really sounds like that. It just sounds like, oh, no, Rufus, it's all right.
You do wonder whether Rufus Wainwright's commercial breakthrough is ever coming. I mean, you know, the amount of broadsheet ink that gets, you know, expended on him, and the amount of celebrity endorsements... versus the actual number of records Rufus Wainwright sells. I think it's astonishing disparity, I mean, particularly in the States, where, you know, they're not really going to go for this sort of openly gay, high camp, you know what I mean?
There is a big disparity, but, I mean, did Jackson Browne ever have huge hits? I mean, he's sort of in the non-hit having tradition.
Randy
isn't he?
Newman or something. Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
Good
Randy
point. Randy,
you know,
Randy
Newman
sold really badly, actually.
Yeah, no. I mean, I think that's the level he'll stay at. Mm. But I think that's fine. You know, he performs to almost two enthusiastic audiences.
Absolutely. Yes. 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 I saw him do the Judy Garland thing
at
the Palladium, which was actually, you know, was amazing sort of thing. A remarkable kind of audience of people. I was like, this is Lulu.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It was proper, all the stars, his first time, all the stars were out, and David Furnish was there, and Elton John, and everything. And he is brilliant, absolutely brilliant live.
Yes, he is.
I wholeheartedly recommend going to see him. I think it's fair to say that if you don't already like Rufus Wainwright, you probably won't like it. This isn't going to do anything to change your mind.
No, that's true.
When's this out? Do we know?
It's out next month, I think, April the 16th.
Is this the single?
This is the first single from the album, yes.
So as much as albums do have singles these days, I suppose. Yeah. Anyway, right, time for my track. That's Palicia. I think it's pronounced Palicia. It's got Cedilla. It's a Polish word. It's got Cedilla on the C. Lay your cards out. Palicia are part of the same sort of collective, or are an offshoot from Gayings, whose album Related. It was probably my favourite record of the year before last. I think what we can safely say was a fairly mixed response from the listeners. But I really liked it. It's a similar sort of thing, I suppose. It's kind of a Minneapolis-based US indie alt types making an R&B influenced pop record. It's less obviously influenced by 70s soft rock, I think, than the Gayings album is. It's got a guy from Bon Iver on it. I just thought it was a really good song, good tune, a big tune. You know, I say the same thing happens. You know, how did you discover it? Well, I had a pile of singles on my desk. This is why, you know, I was going through them. This really stood out. The album is out soon on Memphis Industries. It is already out in the States, I believe. But this track is all over the internet. You can find
Jay-Z it. Jay-Z put it on his blog. That's where
did he?
That's where I first saw it, yeah.
Yeah, he got it off me.
I thought so.
Yeah, me and Jay. He put it on his blog. That's great.
Yeah,
that's really cool.
You can imagine someone rapping over it, can't you?
Yeah,
you can. And particularly
really
that
good.
Sort of thing that he does with, you know, who's that, Mr. Hudson, and you know, he brings those kind of elements into his music, doesn't he, at the moment. Do you like it, Kieran?
I really like it.
Wow.
It was score. So good. Brilliant. I know, I was thinking like, oh Jesus, after last week's Tom Jones fiasco, I just thought, oh no. But
your,
actually,
your
yeah.
flatmate thought you were stupid or something because you were listening to my record.
Yeah,
right, okay.
Like, what the hell is this? Alexis's choice. No, it was really good. I really, really liked it. I kind of liked her vocal, how it was sort of simultaneously quite delicate and actually quite soulful R&B at the same time.
I think one of the things I like about Games and Polizia, however you pronounce it, other than their unpronounceable names, is that I don't think what they're doing is in any way intended ironically. I really don't get that sense of kind of like American alt-rock people who think they're a little bit better than R&B kind of dabbling in it. I think it's sort of equivalent in a way to like what Skritti Politti did in the 80s, where they went from being a scrabbly indie band and he just decided that he preferred listening to electro and R&B and made records in that style. Alex, do you like it?
I did like it, yeah. It's very kind of beautiful sounding. They've obviously paid so much attention to how it sounds. And towards the end, the loads of drums come in and it becomes very epic. Mm. No, I thought that it's very atmospheric. As you say, it's a big tune. Mm. And there is something about it that's quite haunting.
Yeah. I think it's sort of record could be a hit if it got the right, you know what I mean, if it got playlisted. It's playlisted on, it's on the C list at Six Music, so, you know, in no chance, basically. But, you know, I sort of think if it's the kind of thing that if they played it on Radio 1 as opposed to playing whatever they play all the time on radio, I wouldn't know. I never listened
to it.
Example. Yeah. Then it might stand a chance. I don't know.
Yeah, and yeah, that what you said about not being too overpowering, I think, is a really good point, because that, you know, it's got that synthy sound, but it's not really overpowering. It's got those drums and it doesn't take it over. And I think that that's quite nice, actually. It's nice to just take a breath and take a step back and just be like, yeah, this is good.
Lay Your Cards Out by Polizia. The album is coming out soon. I think the album's coming out in April. The single, I think, is out on March the 28th. But, I mean, you can find it on every blog going. It's clearly very popular with the young people. So there you go. Nashville soft rockers The Silver Seas have been piling up the plaudits since their album Shatter Revenge came out in the UK in 2010. Danny Baker even reckons they're the best band in the world. They were over from the States this week and popped into the pod to be quizzed by Michael Hamm.
I'm very pleased to be joined today in the Music Weekly pod by Jason Lenning of The Silver Seas.
Hello.
And his bandmate, Daniel Tashin.
Hello.
That's not your real voice, is it, Daniel?
Sorry. I'm a prankster.
No one likes to worry, no one likes to cry, no one likes mistreated. I'm the one who's lying awake for half the night.
Gentlemen, you're in the odd position of being loved by a very small number of people who love you intensely and being largely ignored by the rest of the world. How does that feel?
Normal. I've never known it another way.
Yeah, that's pretty much used to that by now. I don't really understand why our home base is really in the UK, but that's where it is, and it's fantastic, and I love it being here. I love the culture, I love the literature, I love so many things about the British people.
Yeah, I mean, it's never a surprise that people like it, because we like it too, and so it's sometimes validating, but there's always this sense that there's a, like, it's a competition. And I never have felt that way about it. I'm competitive with myself, and within ourselves, we're competitive with each other about how we make music and wanting it to be better. But in terms of how it plays out in the big, you know, outside of us making music, it's not something that I have really felt is all that important.
How come you don't feel competitive?
I feel competitive about the work, but I don't feel competitive about the success of the work.
You don't feel that you're in an arms race with other groups doing comparable things?
See, I do. No. And I want to feel more like you. I don't know how.
Maybe that's the secret of your success.
Yeah.
That you have the calm and mellow person and the fiercely competitive person who wants to grind the faces of his rivals into the sidewalk.
No, I don't really feel that way. It just, somebody told me once when I was younger that music, whether you liked it or not, was really like a a big battle of the bands, and it was a competition to win the favor of audiences. And I thought, wow, they're really telling me a great secret of life here. I need to really pay attention and understand this. Because I was like, well, how can you think of music as a competition? It's like saying, like, well, do you want Frank Sinatra or the Sex Pistols? And they're totally different.
But at the same time, people only have so much love in their hearts for so many groups, don't they? You're fighting for that little bit of love.
Yeah.
The 2% that they can give you. Now, the bands are coming together of pop craftspeople, isn't it? I mean, you're a producer, aren't you, Jason? Mm-hmm. And you know, you've done tons of other things, haven't you? So is Silver Sea still just one of the many things that you all do?
Yeah, and it's been fun to focus on this more lately because there's actually been more to do, and being able to come here and work has been really great. And it's going to be neat to see how this, for the first time, our experiences outside the studio, I think, are going to begin to inform our experiences in the studio. You know, the reactions we're getting at shows are definitely going to have an impact on the way we approach the next record and how that. So it's in some ways, we're more of a band now than we've ever been, because I think there's all the things that a band gets to be, we're starting to get to be now.
Were you very much a studio thing at the start of the Silver Seas career?
Yeah, we've done, some touring, but it's always been a project that was built around Daniel's songs and a group of people that wanted to support those songs and play them and enjoyed it. And now it's kind of turned into something that sounds like, you know, we sound like us now, which is, I love.
I mean, more specifically, how do you feel the band has changed from going out on the road and really getting into the rhythm of playing your music together night after night after night?
Well, we got to really rely on David. I mean, he's the quarterback. You got to kind of put your, let him set the tempo and let him, got to really rely on your drummer. And luckily, you know, we got the bass player from our records with us, and it's wonderful to have the real band from the album. But you just learn to trust each other. And I think in a lot of situations when I'm playing, it's a pickup band I've thrown together and I'm trying to tell everybody what to do. But in this situation, you know, it becomes more, well, if we're going to play it slow tonight, we'll play it slow. Play it too fast, we'll play it too fast. Just let the thing be what it is, you know, kind of.
If anything, the Silver Seas are about really old-fashioned MOR pop craftsmanship.
Yeah.
Do you think that's something that's kind of ignored in recent years? I mean, especially on the alternative scene, where so many records are collections of noises rather than collections of finely honed songs.
Yeah, I gotta say, something you had mentioned earlier about that really stuck in my mind about the difficulty of crafting a melody, and it actually made me feel kind of a little more pride in what we do and feel like, well, however it's appreciated or not appreciated, at least there's sort of a little bit of real estate that we can kind of plant a flag on and say, this is our métier, this is our specialty, you know, and that's kind of a good one to do. Why not? Yeah. So I enjoy that, and actually I was glad that you reminded me of that, because sometimes it is tempting to want to paint with different colors, and not that you can't use different colors, but at the end of the day, the real job of the artist, I think, is to be a songwriter. I mean, there's a million beats in the world.
Now, the record that brought you to attention over here was Chateau Revenge, which you've put out in two versions, one acoustic and one electric. Is that a cynical attempt to milk your legions of fans dry? Because you know they'll
totally
cough up for both albums.
Yeah, absolutely. Totally. We're just trying to make a little extra bread.
And presumably they've both gone double platinum.
For Gherky's extra room. Yeah. What does he need it for?
Shoes.
Yeah, shoes.
Well, the truth is that the main version, the red version, was the artistic need to express ourselves in different mm-hmm. ways. And anyone who's familiar with our earlier records would know that there's a quieter side to the band, and we've made albums where it's just the four of us in a circle playing acoustic instruments, and that's the album. And so we thought it would be a fun approach to go revisit those songs in the style of some of the earlier things we've done. And we discovered some really neat sides of the songs that I don't know if we knew were there before, and so it was a fun way to kind of have another look at them.
Do you sometimes see live audiences who've maybe only heard one of the records looking shocked when this song comes out in a way that they are not expecting at all?
I mean, I hope that's what that expression is. I was always wondered.
I mean, do you mix the two sets of arrangements up when you play live?
Yeah. It's fun, and I like things where there's extra versions, like Shania Twain's extra versions. I like that, and I like even though they're sort of only loosely connected, but the Red, White, and Blue movies and by
Kozlowski.
Kozlowski.
And the Polish director.
The Polish director Kozlowski. And so yeah, I want to make the white version, which is like the total like minimalist beats, Animal Collective style. You can't even tell what song it is.
The fans always love those albums as well.
They love that. And our fans are gonna be like, all right.
Now, you come from a noted musical family, Daniel. Both your parents are very successful songwriters, and your dad was also the leader of the great 60s garage band, The Remains.
Yes, that's right.
It does seem to be quite common in Nashville because, I mean, the music industry is such a big employer that so many of the people in bands are children of people from the industry as well.
Yeah. Sometimes I get the feeling like people don't want that. Like, sometimes I get the feeling like they kind of like, well, you know, you obviously, you know, have had all the advantages, and they kind of want more of an origin story that they can really get behind, like the, you know, son of a taxi driver or something. They don't want you to have all the tools at your disposal for some reason. I don't know why.
Yeah.
Well, let's just go back. So Daniel, you were born in a sharecropper's shack, weren't you? So, sometime in 1841.
Yeah, I mean, I remember making my first pair of shoes, you know, like, and what a great thing
it was. You had to capture the alligators to make them out of, though, didn't you? Isn't that right? And Jason, you just descended from Mars fully formed. Is that correct?
Yes, dropped right into a tape machine.
Mm-hmm. There, we've got a new origin story for you there. I think that's fine. Now, also, Daniel, you're a big Anglophile. You love Downton Abbey, and you love Scotch eggs. What was it that first attracted you to our glorious nation?
Good question. Maybe Doctor Who?
Who was the doctor at that point?
The best one. Come on, the curly
Tom Baker.
Tom Baker, thank you. Yeah, Doctor Who, and then definitely the music. You know, the Smiths and the Psychedelic Furs. I got that album. That was pretty eye opening. And Robin Hitchcock was a big hero as a kid. Somebody gave me a cassette of Queen Elvis and said, "You're gonna like this." I did.
That was Daniel Tashian and Jason Lenning of the Silver Seas talking to Michael Hand. That's it for this week. Thanks to our guests, Kieran.
Thank you.
And Alex.
Thank you.
Join in at guardian.co.uk/musicweekly. Same time next week. But for now, have a superb weekend. Thanks for listening.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a 1 month, no commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.